Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We have a wonderful author here tonight whose newest book is set in a seemingly idyllic, quiet Colorado town. Andrew Gross's latest High Hawk novel explores the frightening lengths to which we'll go to get one simple thing: water. Marked by his characteristic twists and turns, thrilling pace, and exploration of the human dynamic, One Mile Under does not disappoint. So without further ado, please welcome Mr. Andrew Gross.
Hi, everybody. Very nice to be here. I actually used to live in Denver way back in the day. I won't say what day, because I may look young, but I'm not that young. And but I came out after college, and I was actually in a different life, a dress buyer for those of you who are old enough to remember the May Company store here, May D&F. And then I got hit by a bug, and I opened a restaurant, and it was the first restaurant in Tamarack Square. So I think it's on the other side of town. I've actually never quite been on this side of town, that one actually hastened my writing career. So stews and soups on a fast food basis, and I think if I remember, we hit the statistically warmest winter that we ever had, and I don't think anyone ever even put on a jacket, a parka, that whole time, and here we are trying to sling stews on a fast food basis. In any case, like anything, it leads you to a different chapter of life, and I've actually had a couple of those different chapters before I started writing. So I think what I will do is tell you a little about how this book got developed, and some of the sort of characters and ways that a book comes together. I am going to read some. Normally I don't, but in the 7 or 8 of these I've done on this cycle of a book tour, there's a few pages that I think are pretty good reading, and I think you'll hopefully like hearing, and it's fairly suspenseful and gives you takes you right into the heart of the book. And then obviously we'll open it up for questions, and if you have them, you know, don't be shy. So, you know, how does a book get formed anyway? I generally say that books for me, thrillers for me, are kind of a triangulation of 3 or 4 different themes, leitmotifs, whatever you really want to call it. It's not one thing, especially in a thriller where you're weaving together so many subplots. So the first thing that came along for me happened 17 years ago. I used to take my actually, even though I was born and raised in New York and I only live 20 miles from there, I really like being out west, and my soul is kind of out west, and so we always take vacations, you know, somewhere, usually now in the summer. I used to be in the ski business. I don't know if that's something anyone really knows. I actually used to be the president of Head Skis, Head Tennis, Head Golf. But we would come out in the summers when my kids were younger, and one of the things we would do is whitewater rafting. You know, we take the family on these things, and, you know, sometimes they can be a little hairy. I mean, you know, generally they were class 3s, but, you know, a class 4 at least keeps your eyes open and can be a little scary. And so on one of these trips, it was actually in Jackson Hole. The person who would guide our raft down the Snake River, down this rapid run, was this really kind of sexy, you know, self-reliant, gritty, seemingly fearless gal who had moved out from the East. And, you know, when you put your life in your hands, and, you know, it's sort of like, you know, when you're flying a 2-seater or 4-seater and the pilot, and, you know, and suddenly maybe the pilot is 12 years old and you're wondering, is that person going to get me down? Well, I had a lot of doubts about when all of a sudden this gal climbs in the back, and she was fabulous, and she won me over, of course. So, and, you know, there she was doing this sort of thing, and all the other guides were guys, and I talked to her a lot about that, and so probably had kind of like a one-day crush on this gal, and I always wanted to put her in a book. But it was really when I first started writing, and, you know, life, book life, just didn't take me in that way. Originally, I was writing books with Jim Patterson, so that sort of thing did not fit in. And then even when I went on my own, you know, I just couldn't sort of find the way to do a Western venue book. So I had this gal, and so, you know, what I call it is putting something in the vault. A lot of my books have things in them that, you know, I can't use at the time, but you throw it in your head, and invariably they come back. My last book, Everything to Lose, had two or three things that, you know, were 5 years old, maybe articles that I'd cut out, that you end up saving, and ultimately you sort of find a way to use these things. So I had the gal, and at some point a year ago, when I'm looking to find a new idea to run with, I come across an article in the New York Times, and it's basically on how farmers and ranchers in the drought-stricken oil region of Colorado, up near the Wattenberg Field, I guess near Greeley, are being displaced and are really, you know, suddenly being thrown out of their way of life because water necessary for them is being bid up to such astronomical prices by the oil companies to use in the fracking process. And so I started looking into this, and I loved the dynamic, because what's better than a David and Goliath story of, you know, small people who were being crushed by a large entity, and, you know, oil companies, regardless of your, you know, they're not bad villains, you know. So I saw this thing, and I said, this sort of, for the first time, I really have a chance to sort of write something that's based where I want to do it. Now, I love conspiracies. I think most thriller writers do, but conspiracies for me generally are the delivery system of what I'm really looking to do. And in this book, you know, suspense is obviously part of it. I mean, what better way to sort of create suspense than you have an underdog hero, a David, against the, you know, Goliath of something that's just a large, powerful company. So anyway, I see this article and I'm on it. And what's the third part? The third part is you need a hero. You know who the villain is. I have a gal who's going to sort of be the hero in that, as you see, I'll even read about her. She sort of propels the story for the first 70, 80 pages. But ultimately, I need kind of a warrior. I need a white knight. And I have one. I have a character named Ty Houck, who was a Greenwich detective, head of detectives back east, and was dealing with a lot of things there. Greenwich is a very sort of wealthy circle under the orbit of New York, and, you know, a lot of financial managers. And, you know, my bad guys aren't like killers or serial killers or, you know, people like, or twisted people like that. They're usually people you would recognize, you know, because they're like you if they were sitting next to you. But maybe they have one foot in being a hedge fund manager and possibly another foot in something murkier. And what I like to do is write about bad guys who have some humanity, but where they get bad is that they start to cover up what they do. To me, the cover-up that propels somebody from doing something bad into doing something evil sort of is my territory. So Ty Houck, and I want to bring him back. I've written 5 books since Reckless, which is the last time that Ty has been in a book. Publishers are kind of, I don't know, can I say something nice? Any aspiring writers in this room? I know there's at least one. Then I won't be trampling in anybody's dream. But, you know, like anything, publishers sort of, they're not necessarily visionary people. And I always liken it to the apparel business that I came out of, because anytime you saw a trend, all you did was jump on the trend, and then everybody wanted to run with that trend, and nobody was seeing beyond it. So to some degree, publishers are that way, and everyone began to like when I was writing these standalone books, mostly books about regular people who, through doing something, sort of make some mistake, or through forces they can't control, get them over their head immediately into by you know powers that are just much larger than them, and basically they're on the run immediately. And so I was writing all these standalone books, you know, that were doing real well and getting me on the Times list and all. And I wanted to come back to Ty because people like Ty, women like Ty, you know, because he's kind of a man that you'd want in your foxhole. He's a white knight. He usually takes a quest, generally on behalf of a gal. And I kind of see it almost in the Arthurian cycle of the hero accepting the challenge, taking the quest, failing, being betrayed, and then ultimately, as heroes do, prevailing. So we have Ty. So you have these three things that meld together, and that's basically how this book gets conceived. So I think what I'm going to do is just read you a few pages, and it'll, you know, just to set up what's happened. Danny Whalen is this rafting guide, and she comes upon a body on a routine rafting trip, and as it turns out, it's the body of a friend of hers who's also an expert rider. And even past the grief, this happens outside the town of Aspen, really around Carbondale, actually. She realizes, because of her expertise, that there's no way this guy could have capsized at the spot where he's found. And while everyone else in town, including the sheriff, has put Trey's death, his name is Trey Watkins, death as an accident, she begins to see signs, I won't go through what they are, that it's something much more than that. But she can't convince anybody, and everybody is sort of trampling her down. And the sheriff of the town, Wade, is actually her ex-stepfather, with whom she has a lot of unfinished business with. So just to sort of set up what you're reading here, she's constantly being sort of pushed to, why are you doing this? Why are you ruffling all these feathers? Why are you making all this trouble, Danny? And at some point, this is her reason. And it's a flashback, so that'll come out somewhere in these pages. They were on the upper Colorado River in Gore Canyon two Aprils ago. Anyone been to Gore Canyon? Huh. There were four of them, Chase Gould and Tom Twilliger, both expert rafters. The lure was the biggest early spring runoff in years, over 1,000 cubic feet per second coming down the river, which turned a class 4 into a 5 and a 5 into sheer hell. Trey heard about it, and he called Danny, and they decided to join in. They packed up their gear in Chase's truck and made the 90-minute drive to Kremling. Gore was an unspoiled mountain canyon, lined with snow-capped mountains and jagged cliffs. The 3-mile rapid run through it had some of the most challenging whitewater in the country. Danny had done the run once before, but never with so much water. It started out moderate, applesauce and sweet dreams, easy class 3s, just to stick your toe in the water. The gems were up next. Scissors, which could cut anyone up or flip you over, and pirate, with its deep holes and rocks the size of buildings and a ton of water slashing around. It wasn't just good technique that got you down. This run was also about strength. In the hardest water Danny had ever had to push around. There were plenty of yelps. Oh, there we go. There were. Is that too loud now? No? Okay. Oddly enough. There were plenty of yelps and whoops of exhilaration, paddles raised triumphantly at every chute they made it through. Then they hit Tunnel Falls. Most people do the Gore for the Kirschbaum, a half mile narrow chute of rocks and holes with a 120-foot vertical that builds up speed like a raceway. But the Falls is its signature rapid. Massive rocks on both sides of a narrow chute and then over a 12-foot drop. You have to navigate through it at just the right line. Otherwise, it's a head-first wipeout, guaranteed. And that was with half the water the four of them had that day. Chase was up first, the best and most experienced of them. He'd won a few competitions. The basin at the bottom of the falls had a ton of water thrashing about in it. He hit it just like they drew it up, the rest of them looking on from 30 yards upstream. He disappeared over the edge, spray and foam exploding around him. And from where they were, they had no idea what happened. And then 10 seconds later, they saw him reappear 50 yards downstream, his paddle raised high, his ecstatic whoops drowned out by the turbulent water's roar. Wee. Trey lifted his paddle in appreciation, and they all cheered. Tom was up next. He was no slouch himself, and his red helmet and yellow raft, the back of his craft, careened into a rock just as he went over, and he didn't hit it right. Shit, Trey groaned. Wipeout. Danny watched him go over and couldn't see what had happened below, other than seeing Chase downstream running his finger across his throat, meaning he'd capsized. It took a while until she finally saw Tom again, hanging onto his raft, riding with the current, giving the thumbs up that he was okay. "You ready?" Trey asked Danny. "I'll pick up the rear." It was Trey's way of saying, "I've got you covered if anything happens, and were it anyone but Trey..." Danny would have probably shot back, "You first, by all means." Instead, she just nodded and said, "Last one down buys the beer," and steeling her nerves, pulled into the chute. She never felt there was a run she couldn't make it down, even this one, with more water than she'd ever handled. She knew the trick was to keep the approach steady and hit the falls head-on so that the cross-currents wouldn't pitch you to one side, which was what had happened to Tom. Danny felt her speed pick up and strained to hold the line, but the whooshing current was stronger than she anticipated and pitched her around. As she got within six feet of the drop, she knew she was offline. The back of her raft knocking against a rock, spinning the bow sideways. Her heart leaped up and she tried to correct, but there was no way she was strong enough to push this powerful current around. She basically went over the edge sideways. To this day, she recalled the sensation of her heart toppling even faster than the raft before being slammed by the icy water head first, as hard as if she barreled into a wall, her helmet knocked into something hard, a rock, the bottom, and then the desperate, helpless realization that she was out of the craft in Class 5 water. Over the years, she'd wiped out 100 times. Everyone had. Tom had just a moment before. That's how you learned. Spread your arms and get your feet forward and try to hold on to the line to your craft, she told herself. But the line slipped out of her grasp. She felt the kayak shoot off ahead of her, and when she tried to position her legs forward, it was like they were caught up in something. It took a second for her to realize she was underwater. Her first mistake was to try to yell, which sent a rush of icy water into her lungs. She gagged. She quickly got her wits back, realizing, though, that the fall was disorienting. She'd been caught in some kind of whirlpool, fierce water swirling around. And even with her senses dulled and the knifing sensation of icy water in her lungs, she knew to make herself as still as she could and not to panic or fight what was happening. Let the vortex release her and lift her up. She'd practiced it 100 times, but this time it didn't. A fear began to set in, being thrashed around, not knowing up from down, her eyes stung by frigid water like dozens of bees attacking her, the coldness in her lungs sapping her strength. Stay calm, she told herself, stay calm. But in her agitation, seconds seemed like minutes. She had no idea how long she was under, and she feared she would lose her breath. Her mouth opened, water spilling into her lungs, numbing her. For the first time in her life, she felt fear on the river. Her instincts failed her. It took everything she had to suppress the basic urge to scream. She realized Chase and Tom were way too far downstream to help. No way they could make it back up against the current. And Trey, sooner or later, he would realize what had happened. Chase had probably already given him the sign. But how long would he wait to see if she came through? Or if, coming after her, he'd nail the run perfectly and be swept right past? Panic started to rush into her blood like the icy water in her lungs. She began to feel the very real fear that this could be it for her. Let me up, she started to struggle against it, which was the one thing she knew was wrong. Please. On the deck with Blue, this is when she's having her, Blue is her dog, having this flashback. Looking up at the starry sky, Danny was gripped by the same sensation as if it was yesterday, one she'd never felt until that moment. And hadn't since, the overwhelming feeling that she was giving up, that she was going to die. In the river, she felt water all over her, icy and black, the irony that something she loved so much was now about to kill her. In that moment, her mind actually began to drift to a scene from her childhood, her mother telling her that she was too young to go out on the river by herself, that she'd have to wait another year. She was maybe 10 then. She felt herself being lifted back up. It's working, she remembered thinking, sure that the current was finally giving her up. But it wasn't the current. It was Trey. A hand clamped onto her wetsuit collar, the other hand hanging from a rock, pulling her out. She broke free and sucked a desperate breath into her lungs. She gasped over and over, coughing out water, throwing her eyes back at the beautiful blue sky, heaving. Free. I've got you, Danny, she remembered Trey saying. You were in an eddy, but you can relax. Breathe in. I've got you now. You're safe. She clung to him like he was a buoy in the middle of the ocean, and she started to cry. Geez, and all the really hard stuff is still a ways downstream, he grinned at her. In that offhand way of his, it was a wink that at any other time she would have wanted to throw a punch at, but this time she just smiled herself and hugged him, nodding, wiping away the tears. He positioned her on his chest, feet forward between his legs, and they followed the current downstream to her raft. She stayed with them and finished the curse bow as if it was a three. What's this all about? Wade had asked, not knowing what lay at the heart. She owed Trey. She owed him everything. He hadn't given up on her. No way she was about to give up on him. That's what this was about. So rather than go on anything, maybe it's a good time for questions, and if any are out there on books, publishing, politics, thrillers, religion, nothing controversial. Let me start. I'll go.
What's your favorite part about writing?
My favorite part about writing is writing. I was a business exec for 15 years, and I always thought of myself as a multitasking person who is able to make a lot of, obviously, executive decisions. And I've become, over the time, the least multitasking person on the planet. And, writers are at their best when they're in their books. I like creating suspense. I like weaving stories. And when I'm in that process, I'm a happy guy. When I'm out of that process, meaning trying to come up with an idea for the next book, or at times even selling a book, although I love meeting individuals, I'm less happy, And doing the social media thing, which has become such a onerous part, well, onerous is maybe the wrong word. It is an onerous thing, but, you're supposed to say you love it. It's such a day-to-day demand that, it was funny. I just did a book thing in Colorado Springs. Someone's here from there. And someone posed the question, and so along the same lines, so you started out at some point, how do you feel differently now than when you started? And when I started, writing a book was a privilege, and publishing a book was a privilege. Now, I wrote 6 books with Patterson, and I've written 10 on my own now. It's a career, it's a business, and like any career, it has ups and downs, it has things you're totally gratified by, and it has things that just sort of make you shake your head, in various ways. So I don't know. I guess in a roundabout way, there's my best answer to that. Yes?
I was just going to ask, when you were writing with Patterson, how do you collaborate on a book with 2 different people? Were you in different places?
Well, I don't know how other people do it, but basically we would alternate every word. You're not believing me. It's funny. I've spent 10 years trying to dissociate myself from Jim in terms of my career, but invariably, I always end up talking about him in some way. It's no. I did all weekend in Colorado Springs, because inherently people find him more interesting than me. A lot of people can get cynical about Patterson, and I understand it. Every book I did with Jim came from his idea, and they would not have been written were it not for those ideas. And I don't know, to some degree he's out of the closet, I guess. I generally don't really speak about process, and I don't think he really likes it. Not that You know, I have to figure the statute of limitations is over on ghostwriting from that long ago. But, you know, he'd present me with an outline. Sometimes it was pretty cursory. I rejected a few. I never thought I'd write 6 books with him. And actually, he would say, I've written 5. There is one that we don't speak about. But it was a good deal, and it certainly helped platform me in terms of my own career. When my first book, you know, printed 144,000 copies, won gross, and got to number 10 on the Times list and got sold to 25 countries. If I was just another author publishing my first book, it would have printed 5,000 to 10,000. And I would have very much had to sort of struggle to that point over 6 or 8 books, hopefully, that the trajectory goes this way. You know, but you can always assume that when somebody's name is this and somebody's name is this, the this is doing a bit of the work. And, you know, I think that's a fair assumption. I would also say that Jim always got last draft. And anything could happen in that last draft. Usually he was condensing more than enlarging the story. And the truth is, you know, I always say that Jim reminds me a little bit of the Polo brand, of Ralph Lauren, because you walk into any Polo store around the world and it just has the signature of sameness in every brand. I mean, and, you know, and whatever you want to say about Patterson's work, and clearly he's not the greatest stylist in the world. I don't read him anymore, and I personally don't find him satisfying, but somebody obviously reads him. You know, all these books, whether they're written by whoever they're written by, read like Patterson books. So he's a brilliant guy. I mean, for me, the hardest part is coming up with a story. I mean, I hope I get one story in a year, and he gets one a month, basically. So, you know, I mean, a lot of people begrudge his success. We both have a place in Palm Beach together. Well, I won't say together. His is a little more conspicuous than mine. His is John Lennon's old place. It's beautiful. But, you know, it's easy to sort of, a lot of people poke figures because, you know, his books don't necessarily have a huge amount of substance to them, or I suspect. But he's tapped into something out there. And, you know, I mean, I think all you can do is just sort of say, wish it was me.
Well, I didn't mean it that way. No.
Yeah.
You know, process.
No, I went off on that. I wasn't saying. I'm back now though. Yes.
Is it okay to ask you, like, how did you get together with Patterson? I mean, what was the last thing you did on your career?
All right, I'll tell you, because I told it this weekend up in.
I didn't know if you were allowed to ask.
No, I mean. Actually, that's a less controversial question than saying, you know, who did what, maybe. You know, I had written a book called Hydra, which is still my email, actually. I just left the business that I was – I didn't leave it. I came home on a Wednesday without a job. I was running a Canadian ski and sportswear company. And I had been doing all these turnarounds, and I – one just didn't turn around, and I was spent. I was done. So I sort of just told my wife that. She said, you know, what are we going to do? We have 3 kids in private school, and you've just had this succession of 3 jobs. And I just said, I'm not leaving any more blood on the field. I'm cooked. So I said, what I want to do is write a novel. And, you know, so I spent a year writing a novel. But as anyone knows who's tried it, first novel, it doesn't take a year. It takes a year to put some words on the pages. It takes another year to polish them. And then it takes a year to, at least, maybe more, to market it. And so I found myself 3 years without any revenue coming in and 3 years of drifting farther and farther away from anything that I knew how to do as a living and realizing I probably couldn't get in it. So I wrote this book. It was called Hydra. It was a political conspiracy novel. And I got close. I found a big shot agent in New York. They were all in love with it. They were always saying the street was abuzz with it. And sooner or later, I got 25 rejection letters. And I didn't have any clue what I was going to do with my life, and all I could look at was this trajectory that used to be going this way and now was this way. And I was sitting around my den, and I get a phone call, and someone says, out of the blue, can you take a call from James Patterson? So I said, yes, I'm available. But, you know, I won't go into it in more depth, but, you know, Patterson then wasn't the Patterson now. He wasn't really this textbook brand management case. He had never had a number one bestseller, actually, before moi. You know, but he had two good books behind him. He had several books behind him, but he had two great ones, Kiss the Girls, Along Came a Spider, which still may be his best. In any case, he just got on the phone with me and said, you've got the goods. I read your book. I said, what are you talking about? You read my book, my manuscript. And unbeknownst to me, the president of Little Brown, who rejected the book, gave him the manuscript and wrote on the cover, this guy does women well. Which I think meant that that I wrote him well, you know, and so he needed someone who did women well because he had this idea for four women crime fighters, which became the Women's Murder Club series, which is a debate whether I was on the first one or the second one. You can't find me on the first one, but I was there. Yes.
You said that sort of coming up with a story is a difficult part for you. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, is it the initial idea? Is it coming?
Well, you missed it. If you were here on time, you would have known exactly what it is. I won't go through it all, but basically, I call it a triangulation. So the various different themes that sort of come together, usually one defining theme, but you know, you need. In a plot-intensive book, you need a lot of places you can go, and so it isn't just one thing. I mean, I wrote a book called 15 Seconds, where I was once on book tour in Houston, and I got pulled over by a cop, and I got in an argument with him. I seemed like a nice guy, right? But and it escalated, and he actually pulled me out of the car and cuffed me and threw me in the back of his car and told me I was under arrest, and like immediately, like 10 police cars come and they block off the street, and it was like they had Timothy McVeigh or something in the back and not me, and they didn't believe I was a book guy. They didn't know where, you know, and I was like, I'm just going to a book signing. I'm an author. I just came from the airport. Anyway, I won't go into the whole story, but it ended benignly for me. But as I was sitting there in the back of this car with a lot, and I was questioned a lot about, you know, what were you doing in a federal office building in downtown Houston? I mean, obviously, you know, it wasn't me. And I started thinking what would happen if eventually it melted back to the same cop, the one cop everyone left. And it was clear that they weren't going to arrest me and they were going to let me go, that I wasn't whoever they thought I was. And I was thinking, while he was still in his car, what if somebody just came by and went, pow? Everybody would think that I did it because everyone had seen me in with this policeman there, you know. So that sort of spun an idea to me, and it became a book, 15 Seconds. But generally, that doesn't happen to a writer. So those kind of experiences don't often propel a book. Generally, we're, you know, thriller writers are probably the dullest people on the planet. So we're sitting there 98% of the time in front of our computers, you know, like feeding the dog and, you know, getting the mail, all that stuff. So, yes, sir.
Can you talk about how you manage your writing time?
Well, you know, if you get a book out a year, you gotta. It's more muscle than inspiration. Let's put it that way. You got to be at your desk and you got to do the work. And I work 6 days a week. I usually, you know, get to my desk between 8 and 8:30. Writers call it warm up. I call it fucking off, basically. And sorry, but I check, you know, I'm on Facebook. I'm you know, looking at my stocks. I'm you know, answering emails. And you know, at some point, and I'm playing solitaire. But you get yourself into a state where you're ready to go. And so I'm usually by 9:30 at the latest. I start by looking at what I wrote yesterday, which I thought sort of use generally sort of assails these great heights of the craft. And when I read it again the next day, I realize that it's unpublishable, you know, not, you know, and I can't believe, like, they really pay me for this stuff, you know. But you loop back, you work, you polish up, you get something presentable. Usually by the second day, what I have is presentable. Sometimes it isn't right for the book, though, until 8 to 10 revisions, you know. And then I try to write a chapter a day, because the way that I structure a book is generally about 80 chapters, 4 to 5 pages a book, something like that. So I have manageable chapters. You know, some chapters are 6 to 7 pages, some chapters are 3 to 4 pages. My short chapters are not Pattersonian short chapters, and so I try to write a chapter every day. I'm a great believer in outlining. As a matter of fact, I have taught, and I'm teaching one in July at something called Thriller Fest, which is a great thriller convention in New York. I learned it from Patterson, quoting him again. But the truth is, I think it's key for any aspiring writer, especially if you're writing these plot-intensive stories. I outline very thoroughly. If you read my, as a matter of fact, the first book I sold of my own, The Blue Zone, I sold as an outline. You would have thought you read the book. I am switching gears and publishers on my next book. If anybody asks what I'm working on, I'll be happy to tell you for the next in the next question. But I sold an outline for that too. Very rare that a fiction author can actually get a contract off of an outline. But my outlines are 60 pages long, and I go through the process of what I call playing chess with myself, because it's really hard work, and you literally have to sort of think 50 moves downstream, which is hard. But I find that upfront work is the best work on the book. So usually, even though you can always deviate from it, I have a roadmap every morning when I go to work. And like I said, you can shift, you know, every book sort of kills someone earlier, throws someone into bed earlier. There's a character that starts out being a secondary character who suddenly just has this energy. Like in this book, there's, well, Danny I knew was going to be, I mean, everyone quite loves her and loves the dynamic between she and Ty. It's sort of this quirky sort of father-daughter, well, he's a godfather relationship. But there's also a guy in here named Wade, the sheriff, who I think just ends up taking on a lot more resonance than I ever intended him to take in the book. That's very common. So you can deviate. But basically, I have a roadmap. So that's sort of how that works.
All right, Albite, what are you working on?
Good question. So I'm changing gears on the next couple of books. And some of it is a business issue, because the thriller market is just so saturated now. And I was telling Erica in there that it really is a bit of a zero-sum game in the thriller business right now. And, I mean, I have my fans, and I do pretty well, but I can't. It's very hard for me to grow them. I mean, I'm just not going to be, you know, the only person who has branded himself in my neck of the woods, meaning sort of ordinary, everyday heroes, suburban sort of storylines, is Harlan Coben. He's the only one. No one else has been able to do it. You know, there's me, there's a guy named Joe Finder, I like a guy named Linwood Barkley, I don't know if anyone's read him, Greg Hurwitz. I mean, these are all sort of people, we're all fighting for the same thing. And I mean, I'm ahead of those guys, but I'm nowhere near Harlan. So I decided that I really want to go after the books that I want to read more than the books that I'm paid to write. And I'm writing, it still is a thriller, but it's set in World War II. I really want to go after either historical places or just deeper senses of setting and place than I have in the past, where it almost doesn't, this book actually has a great sense of place. It's in your backyard, but most of my books take place in a suburban world that could be anywhere, you know. And so I'm really sort of going after something different. But I'm writing a book that's set in World War II. It's about smuggling Jews out of occupied territory. It's called The One Man, at least provisionally. And the one man is a scientist who can make the difference, can change the war through the Manhattan Project. And they need to get him out. And when they're unable to smuggle him out, he ends up in Auschwitz, and a Pole is sent back who has just made it to the United States, and he has to go back to the place where his entire family was killed in order to get inside Auschwitz and take this man out. So it's filled with a lot of things besides suspense. My father-in-law is a 95-year-old person who, in fact, left Poland 6 months before the invasion in 39, and his entire family, extended family, was killed. He has no idea what happened to them, and he never wanted to look into it, and he's always had this sadness inside him because of this gravity, and he's never spoken about it. My wife has no idea what one generation back and her family was like, but I've always sort of wanted to put a voice to what he, you know, what he won't speak of, and so this is my way of doing that for him. I think it'll be a great book, and, you know, I hope World War II is still topical when it gets out. You know, I was telling Erica again that I sort of feel like 70 years later, I hope I don't miss it by 6 months, you know? It's sort of like, you know, Kashmir for last season, you know? And, oh, no. So, anyway, yes.
What made you think you could write?
Because I was a Garmento. True, my resume did not back this up. I was published even in high school. I actually had poems published nationally. And I went to a school called Middlebury in Vermont, and I sort of went there as kind of a literary jock, if that's the right way to put it. And I did edit the literary magazine as an underclassman, and I always felt I could do this. I have gaping holes in my early mystery reading, history, but I'm pretty good on important books. You know, you give me the top 100 books, I can hold my own on them with anybody. So I never really thought I'd be doing this. But the truth is, as I began in the 70s to read these great thrillers like Marathon Man and so Len Deighton's and people like that, and Morris West and William Golding, and something called The Windchill Factor by Thomas Gifford, or, you know, Charles McCarry. I mean, these were all sort of people writing great thrillers in the 70s, and that's what I was weaned on. And at some point, I just said, for two reasons. One, I like to create suspense, and if I'm going to write, that's what I want to do. And two, I would rather be where the money is than when it isn't. And for the most part, it's a category. I don't think it's a growth category anymore. It probably should go into fantasy or erotica or something. You know, since I don't know anything about that, I'm sure I can do that. You know. Okay, so I guess yeah, one more. Yeah.
So did you have a follow-up project after this?
I do, but you know, I think I'm gonna write a book, a thriller that takes place in the Hasidic community in Brooklyn, in New York, which to me is, even though it's not a historical, it's so rich in its venue that it really is transporting someone to another place and time. But I have a storyline. I'm Jewish, but I'm not sure that I want to be identified as a Jewish-specific novelist, and I'm not sure my publisher wants to identify me that way either. But if I had to say what I wanted to write next, it would be that, you know. We'll say, you know. Is there one more, or they'll, or
we can throw one more in.
I came a long way. I've been out here for waited around 2 days to talk to you guys. So, yeah.
This is about water. I thought it was
yes.
Oil.
Ah, I'm glad you asked. It's about water. Now, water and oil, in the case of this book, are sort of water is like money, in this case. So that's what it is. It really, you know, people are saying, like, what's your view on fracking? And I say, but it's really about water rights and taking people away from their way of life. And that's sort of what the story is about. But I hope you'll read it, and I hope you'll see that it's very much sort of, you know, leads through an oil company, but it's basically the one commodity that's more valuable than oil, which it is in those regions, is water. So, well, thank you all. Thanks for coming out.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodin. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.